On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A green building movement is taking hold across the United States. Global warming, rising energy costs, people are rethinking how they design their homes. Green or environmentally friendly construction means better insulation, energy efficient heating, and much more. This hour On Point, the green building boom. Joining me now from Fairfield, Connecticut is Jim Motovalli, editor of E, the environmental magazine. The magazine's cover story is Building Greener, an Eco Revolution is Transforming Our Approach to Design and Construction from Home and Office to Entire Communities. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Great to be on, Jane.
Also with us from Eugene, Oregon is G.Z. Brown. He is professor of architecture at the University of Oregon and a longtime expert on energy issues and energy efficiency. Professor Brown heads the Energy Studies in Buildings Lab at the university and advises architects and designers on green building techniques. Professor Brown, nice to have you here as well.
Thank you, Jane.
Jim Motovalli, let's start with you. Define, if you would, for us right off the bat, green building. What exactly is it?
Well, the thing is, if you just talk about the concept of green building, it's really vague. It's like saying a product is natural. It has no actual definition. It can be used to enhance any the salability of any product. But if you give that green building concept a set of standards, if you try to hold it to be accountable, then you would develop green building standards and you get what's called the LEED program, and the U.S. Green Building Council came up with a set of standards, which is called the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design Program, or LEED. And then you have a set of guidelines that you can use to judge whether a building was really green or not. To say a green building, you're just talking about making a building more energy efficient, using greener materials, more earth-friendly materials, using less chemicals in the makeup, less glues and adhesives, and less toxic materials, because I think most people don't realize, among other things, that the interior of a home can be 2 to 5 times more, the air can be 2 to 5 times worse than the outside air.
And because it's
so contained.
You're breathing that in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and people spend 90% of their time inside, so it's a concern.
Let's talk about buildings first up, construction, commercial buildings, because in your article you say they are energy hogs, the worst thing people do to the environment. Give us the numbers. How much do they consume?
Well, I think people don't realize that buildings, for instance, are about a third of the country's greenhouse gases. People don't think that buildings are really part of the problem. They think of power plants and they think of auto exhaust as contributing to global warming, but 33% of it is from buildings. And buildings also consume 65% of all electricity, 12% of drinkable water, 40% of all raw materials. And, you know, they are indeed energy hogs. They're consuming a whole lot of the oil and the material that we import from the Middle East. A lot of that is going into buildings.
Professor Brown, how does that compare to, say, cars and trucks, which we hear so much about?
Well, as Jim pointed out, the buildings use more than either the transportation sector or the industrial sector. They're both about the high 30%.
What's driving the push, Professor, toward building more environmentally friendly buildings?
Well, I think that people are interested in protecting the environment. That's a primary motivation in the Northwest. And in addition, you save money for energy costs. And perhaps most importantly, there's evidence that you increase productivity in offices buildings. If you use daylighting and natural ventilation, you improve patient recovery time in hospitals, and you even improve test scores in schools.
We'll talk about that. You just finished a prototype, actually, of a green school. What's the bottom line there?
The bottom line is wonderful. We were able to reduce energy use by 70% compared to current Oregon code, and we did that at a reduction in first cost.
And as far as productivity rates in green buildings, you've studied that extensively as well.
Yes, productivity. It takes just a very small increase in productivity to equal the energy savings. So there's evidence out there that says productivity increases between 2 and 10%. And just as small as 0.5% would more than equal the savings from energy cost. So the productivity benefit, if it proves to be as true as it seems to be, would be really terrific.
Jim Motovalli, can you quantify it? Do you know how many green buildings are going up in the United States today?
That's a really good question, and I think it's very difficult to quantify. 5% of new commercial construction meets LEED standards, but if you ask the National Association of Home Builders, they'll tell you that 50% of all builders are involved in green building, but that's a very sort of vague concept. Again, green building itself does not have a definition. You have to build to some kind of standard. So how many new buildings going up, what percentage are really green? It's very hard to say, and there's many different ways of looking at that. It's like trying to quantify how many vegetarians there are in the United States.
Right.
There's many conflicting statistics.
Well, not everyone is jumping on the green building bandwagon. I just read a report suggesting that most home builders still use the same means, methods, and materials as they did 30 years ago. So is it really a trend? Are people really taking this seriously?
Well, I would say that's one of our biggest obstacles is convincing existing home builders and construction of office buildings and other things. The people who do that and have been doing it the same way for a long time, getting them on a new track is very difficult, even if there are obvious benefits to them. You know, I'm on the Clean Energy Task Force in my town in Connecticut here, and we've been trying to influence the construction of new municipal buildings in town. And even with a public works director who's really green and sees all this, they just built a new library and they ignored all the green standards that were supposed to go into that building. Simply because they've always done it that way, they've got familiarity with the suppliers and they're used to working with particular set of materials. And so a lot of stuff that is even specified gets thrown out at the actual on-the-ground stage. So we're trying to come up with a new set of green codes for the town. And in only a very few places around the country, Berkeley, California is one, and Burlington, Vermont another, are there actual mandatory green codes for home owners. That's a very rare thing right now. For the most part, only government buildings have any kind of mandatory green standards.
You bring us to the point of raising awareness about this problem. And in your article, one point stuck out particularly when you say, when you turn on a light switch, that means coal is mined, which goes to a power plant that comes up the stack as acid rain, producing planet-cooking carbon dioxide. Fair to say the average consumer doesn't make that link.
Definitely not. Of course, that's not always true because in some states, California, for instance, most of the energy is produced in a greener manner. They don't have coal plants and they don't even have very many nuclear plants as far as I know. So it matters a whole lot where you live, how that electricity is produced and whether there's coal involved and that kind of stuff. But for the most part, people don't imagine a polluting smokestack when they turn on a light, no.
Professor Brown, do most people associate the green movement with inconvenience? And is there a perception that also green construction is more expensive?
Yes, there's definitely the perception that green construction is more expensive. And that's one of the things that we've been trying to prove is not necessarily the case. And the school room that you mentioned before is a good example of that. It's if a building is designed properly in the first place, meaning is it's designed integrally to be green, it doesn't cost more. In fact, I think you could make the case that it costs less. And we spend a lot of time consulting for architects and engineers, showing them how to do that. The buildings on campus, for example, that we're building here are all 40 to 50% better than the energy code, and they're all done within the construction budget.
And what about the inconvenience factor? People saying, do I have to give up my modern comforts to live in a green home?
Well, it's an interesting thing because people, you know, buildings don't really use energy. It's people that use energy. And when they're designed for what, for example, to have 24-hour use, when in fact they're only used maybe 10 hours a day. And by just being sensitive to how buildings are really used by people, they can save a lot of energy, and they're not inconvenient at all. But people's perception, sometimes they feel that they are until they get to try one and see that they like it.
What about the value, Jim Motovalli, the value of a green home or building? Is it lower than a conventional construction? Because I think that is perception as well.
There's a lot of factors at work there. In some cases, you'd have to admit that if you personalize a house too much, you make it too much to your own specifications, you could lower the value. And that may be possible if you put on a whole lot of green innovations and some people don't want to live with those. That could be true. But on the other hand, I think most people would probably find a house of more value if it has lower energy costs. And an interesting thing to look at in relation to home construction now and how long it takes for some of these energy innovations to pay back is that there are many state, local, and federal subsidies available if you make your house more energy efficient. For instance, in Connecticut here, we have the Clean Energy Fund, which is paid for with funds from the utilities. And you can get 50% of a solar panel paid for, the cost of installing that. So your payback time is greatly reduced.
Jim Motovalli, I was interested to read a fact in preparation for this interview that the average private home in this country has doubled in size from about 1,100 square feet in the 1950s to 2,100 square feet, 2,100 square feet today. So the question is, with our proclivity for living large, can the green building movement really make headway? Is the work of one green builder negated by a slew of traditional builders?
Well, you've hit on a sore point with me, Jane, because I think it's a shame that, in particular, our houses have gotten a whole lot bigger on average. But green buildings tend to be bigger than average, too. In fact, the average green home, I would say, is more like an eco-mansion than it is like an eco-home. And we have to start thinking smaller. And I think a few innovative designers have begun to do that. They've talked about the small eco house, the compact one, the one that's 1,500 square feet instead of 6,000. And I think that most of us grew up in homes that were 1,200 to 1,500 square feet. And we know that it's possible to live without, six bedrooms for three people.
Right.
It really is
right.
Possible to do that. But I think you do negate all the environmental benefits of your home if you make it that big.
I want to get a caller in. We have many people lining up to join the conversation. Bill is calling from Amherst, Massachusetts. Bill, go ahead. Hello.
Hello, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually a carpenter in town, and I work for a green builder, Sunwood Builders, and we do all of our interior trim is all recycled material. But what I was just wanted to comment on was what you were just and your guests were just talking about was making houses smaller. I know, I forget her first name, like Mrs. Suzanka is a designer and architect and has written a book, The Not So Big House. And I think that it's just a wonderful way to really reduce energy costs is just by making things smaller, and that is in and of itself a huge gain rather than worrying about everything that is green, although that is very good, but just trying to get houses smaller and more human-sized would really make a big impact on just the amount of materials used and then still use bamboo flooring or recycled trim and blown cellulose for insulation would be a huge step.
Mm. Bill, thank you for that thought. I appreciate it. Let's, on that note, head to Austin, Texas. Ray Tongis is a home builder there. He is gradually incorporating environmentally friendly technologies and materials into his building. Ray, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Has green building gone mainstream in your neck of the woods?
Well, it is steadily progressing. In fact, Austin was the home of the first green building program that was started in 1991, and this was actually a byproduct or a continuation of the Energy Star program that started in the early 1980s, around 1984. So my market here in Austin has been very progressive in energy conservation for the last 20-plus years.
Do you see traditional builders changing their ways, Ray, starting to build green? Do you see builders saying, I'm not waiting for the government to mandate it, I'm going to do it myself, this is a good thing to do?
Well, Jane, you have to be aware that we're in business and we have to build to the marketplace. So, you know, it really comes back to what consumers demand.
So what is the consumer demand for green building there?
Well, we're starting to see an uptick in that. And I think nationally we're seeing the same thing. There's a heightened awareness of energy and conserving and stewardship. And I like to say that there's nothing like a good crisis that transforms the marketplace. And a few months ago when we had $70 a barrel oil, that was kind of a tipping point in a lot of consumers and industry professionals' mind that, you know, we really need to start addressing these issues.
Well, let me ask you this. How easy is it, Ray, to go green as a builder? Because you hear stories, and I read them preparing for this interview, of builders having difficulty finding certain materials, eco-friendly materials, that leaves a project months behind schedule. And, of course, that makes the homeowner not terribly happy. Then there's the cost. Tell us your experience. Is it easy and cost-effective to go green from your perspective?
Well, it really is, and I think one of the things you got to understand is that you know, our market is fairly low tech, and our market is slow to change. But we're seeing an acceleration of that, and one of the ways that this is starting to accelerate and is that there's more green building programs popping up around the country. As we speak, there's about 24. Home Builders Associations across the country that have green building programs. 15 of those have started in the last year that are based on the National Association of Home Builders National Green Building Guidelines. There's 12 more in development right now. And what you see is when you hit critical mass in a marketplace, you start to see all these trends to get much easier because the education is in place. Here in my state of Texas, we've seen a steady progression as, one is we instituted the statewide building code in 2001, 2003, a statewide energy code that really transformed the marketplace, and now we're getting ready to adopt the 2006 edition of the International Energy Code, which is another step forward in continually moving the bar in our industry. So it is definitely getting easier to build green.
A lot of people are calling, saying we'd like to go green but don't know how. Holly is one of them from Nashville, Tennessee. Holly, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi. Greetings from Music City.
Thank you.
My husband and I are considering getting a new roof put on our house, and we figured since we need to do this and there's a remodel involved, we might as well try to maximize our southern exposure and put on a solar roof. And then we found out how much it might cost. So I'm wondering, are there any grants that can be applied for? I know you mentioned that there might be a tax benefit in Connecticut. Is there anything going on in Tennessee or with any of the universities in Tennessee that could then use our home as a living lab?
Perhaps a good question for all of our guests, whomever wants to jump in.
Well, I would suggest that you call the architecture school at the University of Tennessee and speak with Mark Decay.
a personal suggestion there. Professor Brown, thank you for that.
Another place to look is your local utilities. A lot of local utilities have conservation programs that offer rebates for different home improvements.
Professor Brown, let me ask you while I've got you. You believe that green building should be mandated for both public and private building development. Is that happening?
Oh, absolutely. Codes are probably the most fundamental way you do that. And they're improving. They're not improving as rapidly as they have in the past because there's a fair amount of political resistance because people believe that that buildings cost more, and that's why that we do the research we do to prove that they don't. But I think that standards are improving for sure. But in the Northwest, the incentive programs and, for example, our lab is paid for, the work is paid for by the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance to give free advice to architects and engineers on certain kinds of projects to help them understand how to improve the performance of their buildings, and it's making quite a difference. Mm.
Ray Tanjas, you're a builder in Austin, Texas. Do you think, generally speaking, that building codes encourage you as a builder to build green?
Well, certainly mandatory code compliance is always an issue, and sometimes that's your local municipality that's going to be more aggressive with that. I would like to point out a really landmark partnership that was created just a week and a half ago in Orlando at our International Builder Show. And there's two things of significance. One is that the National Association of Home Builders and the International Code Council are partnering in the development of taking the National Green Building Guidelines through the standards process. The American National Standards Institute, which is a consensus body, we're going through that process with these guidelines so that we do have some standardization across the country that will allow for enough flexibility in the local market to deal with local building conditions and climate differences.
Thank you. I want to get to the phones because we have a lot of people who have questions. Ed is calling from Tewksbury, Massachusetts. Ed, hello.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. My wife and I are very excited to be moving into a huge green project in Lawrence, Massachusetts, where Bob Anson is converting the largest mill in Lawrence, which was built in 1905, into mixed-use retail and condominiums, and he's heating the whole thing geothermally. So it's the largest geothermal heating project, we think, in the country. Hmm. And we're also, of course, using an existing building, a building that was built in 1905. So there's a lot of exciting things going on. We're going to have a green rooftop, lots of green park, and like I say, there's geothermal heat, which doesn't use fossil fuel, and we'll cut our heating bill in half. And it's a very exciting project. Right?
Did you anticipate doing this, Ed, or did you kind of fall into it?
Well, I do a lot of volunteer work in Lawrence, so I've been looking for a reason to move there, and then along comes Bob and buys his mill, and sort of a lot of things came together for us. But the green piece of it is really exciting to us, and we think it's going to be a wonderful place to live.
Ed, thanks for your call. Jim Motivalli, is building green more expensive? How much do green features add to the total cost of a home?
I don't have an actual percentage. They do definitely add to the cost of a home. But you can offset that, as we've been discussing, and I think it's great that that caller was trying to find out if there were subsidies that will help pay for her solar roof, and there definitely are, and it's a patchwork of state and federal laws. You have to look up what is applicable to you, and as I mentioned earlier, in Connecticut, it's gotten incredibly cheaper to add this stuff on, and your payback is 2 or 3 years, and you have to think about the fact that while you may be putting a little bit more out up front, in the end, you're going to be actually saving a fair amount of money. That's
right.
The benefit. What you have to look at is what the payback time is. And you have to not only look at what the initial cost is, but also the payback time and when you're going to actually be saving money, which is increasingly not that long a time. Both the materials have gone down in cost and the subsidies available have gone up. And that's one of the things that we're talking about a green renaissance now. You mentioned earlier that in the 70s there was sort of an abortive green home revolution, and there was a solar movement then, and Jimmy Carter put solar panels on the White House.
Yes.
Ronald Reagan took them down.
That's right, he did.
So I hear that they're back up there now.
That's good to know.
But that was symbolic of the whole movement. It just when Reagan removed subsidies for solar, it sort of killed it at the time. But the panels themselves are technically so much better now, and the costs have come down so much that's another reason it's happening now.
Bruce is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
For 17 years, I was the producer of This Old House on public TV, and now I'm a consultant helping people with their renovations. And I point out to everybody I can get a hold of that there's really nothing greener, and I was happy to hear about the place up in Lawrence, than recycling a home by renovating it. All that embodied energy does not have to be thrown into a dumpster on your way to a so-called scrape job to put up a new house of any sort. by renovating it in place, you're well on your way to a green maneuver anyway.
Bruce, thank you. Professor Brown, agreed?
Oh, definitely agreed. But I would like to add that it's really important to make a distinction between supplying energy and reducing demand for energy.
Mm.
And a lot of the design work in existing or new buildings is about reducing the demand so that the furnace size, for example, is smaller as well as using less energy.
Joe is calling from Priest River, Idaho. Joe, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, ma'am. I'd just like to make the comment. I build homes up here, and we basically incorporate a lot of the green technologies, but my number one complaint with it all is just the society's negative connotation with the term. I mean, immediately they start thinking of straw-baled homes, geodesic domes, mm-hmm. and of the like, and I think if you guys could come up with a better name, it might be more viable.
Ray Tanjas, is it about marketing a little bit?
That's certainly a good observation, because one of the things that has hindered the progression of the green building movement is the highly publicized unique properties. As he mentioned, straw bale, rammed earth, this type of thing. You know, it makes good media coverage, but it is not practical. The real value comes with mainstreaming green building practices. And as we're going to start to see more and more, we're already seeing it quite a bit in California and in Arizona, where the production builders are starting to do more, green building projects. And that's what's really going to transform the marketplace.
Do you foresee a day, Ray, when green building will be the norm?
Well, a few years ago, our national president of the Association of Home Builders mentioned at one of our first conferences, if you're not building green in 10 years, you're not going to be building. We like to say that, 5 years from now, green building will be called building.
Mm. Ray Tanjas joining us from Austin, Texas, president of Ray Tanjas Builder Incorporated. Ray, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Jim Montevalli, what about that? The day when green building will be the norm, do you see it?
Yes, and I think there's a number of forces that are coming together. You know, you've heard of the perfect storm. Well, the combination of the fact that we now know that climate change is real and indisputable, and the fact that we're facing peak oil, if you take those two things together, you're looking at mandatory energy conservation in the United States. We're looking at having to make a major change from burning fossil fuels. Mm. We don't have this is not like a pretty little thing that maybe we should do and it's all very nice and we can all join hands and sing kumbaya. It's something we're going to have to do.
We're talking this hour about the green building movement. With us is Jim Motivalli, the editor of E!, the environmental magazine. We're also joined by GZ, Charlie Brown. He's a professor of architecture and an energy expert at the University of Oregon, where he heads the Energy Studies in Buildings Lab. And joining me now in studio is Amy Tai. Amy is a real estate agent in Cambridge, Massachusetts, overseeing the sale of a green condominium development. Amy, nice to see you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I drove by your development this morning, in fact, and I'd like you to describe it for us. What is it?
This is Fresh Pond Greenway, and it's 25 units of brand new construction. We are now 30% sold. We just got the occupancy to get people in there. We are in an Energy Star building, so we worked with Energy Star in partnership to make sure that we could bring in things that were green. I mean, I've been listening to the conversation, and I think we can call this a green building because Energy Star has been a part of the process of building it with us.
So when I walk into this building, do I know it's green? Am I going to immediately be able to say, a green building?
No. No.
Describe it.
It looks just like any other high-quality condominium complex. I mean, there's when you walk in, and most of the units, actually all the units have bamboo flooring, and that is something that people say, you know, what is this? It's new. Why is that green?
And why is that important?
Bamboo flooring? Bamboo is a material that is easily replaceable. It's sustainable. If you have a maple floor, it's about 60 to 50, 70 years to grow that floor. But bamboo, you can grow it in about 5 years. And you don't have to destroy a whole forest. So it's a sustainable product.
I have a list of some of the resources that are in this building. Dual flush toilets.
We have dual flush toilets.
And what are those?
These are toilets. It's sort of a funny story because at first people weren't – I've actually been talking to a lot of people about it. They're kind of like, why is that an important thing? It's a toilet that looks like a regular toilet. Doesn't look strange. It doesn't look funky. If you want to flush a little bit down, you just flush down. And if you need to use a lot of water, you flush up. But it's funny to sort of start talking to real estate agents and brokers and the public about it. They kind of are like, why are you talking to us about toilets?
And but it saves a lot of water, bottom line.
Well, many of the units face Fresh Pond, and that's the drinking source of
it's reservoir.
It's the reservoir for Cambridge. It's one of four. So that's the water that you flush in your toilet is potable, is drinkable. So you're looking at, you know, this resource of water right across the street, and you're just wasting water every time you flush. So it's the idea of making that connection. It's not just dual flush toilets. It's the connection of your resources in your home.
Low flow shower heads and water taps, carpet tiles made of recycled materials, countertops made of recycled glass and other things. Is this sort of the thing that people want? Are they asking for this, Amy?
Well, let me just correct you that some of those materials are not in Greenway, but those are the kinds of materials that we could find. We basically, when working with Energy Star, worked with the mechanicals and the heating systems, and people are very interested in those. We have a hot water tank system, which is one tank, and so that reduces the amount of gas that you need to bring in. It reduces the amount of water you need to heat, and it's efficiently run, so to run it is also going to be less expensive. So those are really where Energy Star and the green components come in.
Would you say there's a growing cachet attached to green building?
Meaning, do I think people are really interested in it?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I've had probably 700 people through the building, through the construction in the last year, the public. And people are very interested. Some people don't really have an idea. They'll say, is there a green roof? Is that why it's a green building? But when you start to explain the systems and the connection to the resources, they understand it, and people are very interested.
There's talk that Boston may be one of the first major cities in the country to require private developers
yes.
to adhere to a strict set of green building standards. What would those standards entail generally?
I think Boston's following the lead example. I think Boston is asking that all of the commercial buildings, if not residential, that I'm not sure about, but be qualified for one of the LEED standards.
And what is a LEED professional? You are one. What does that mean?
It means that I'm someone who can look at the systems of a building and work with a team to help get the building certified to whether or not it actually meets these standards. LEED, as I think one of your guests said, is a voluntary set of standards that are used nationally and internationally. A LEED professional, there's 25,000 of them in the country. Usually it's builders and architects. The real estate agents, I'm one of 15. So I'm really kind of out there as a LEED professional in real estate. But it means being able to talk about a building, being able to talk to builders about it, being able to bring resources in, and being able to say, this is a green building or this isn't a green building.
How does the price point for your green condos compare to other similar sized condos in the area?
We're very competitive. We're very competitive. We're at a very good price point.
Amy Tai, thank you. Hold there for a moment. I'd like to go to the phones again. Lots of people are calling. Luke is calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Luke, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's Beaufort, South Carolina. I'm actually right by Paris Island.
Wonderful.
Actually, I just wanted to comment on the fact that concrete construction also corresponds with the green construction as well, because of that we use such thick panels. I'm in construction myself. We use such thick panels that it's more energy efficient. It holds in the cold air. It holds in the hot air. And on the safety sake of it, we have 5 to 6 hour burn ratings on the walls at the same time.
Mm. So you're using a lot of those construction materials yourself in your building. Luke, thank you for your call. Mary is calling from Black Hills, South Dakota. Mary, you're on the line.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
We built a house entirely environmental. It's made of foam panels, and we have bamboo flooring, and we have a very inexpensive solar panel system and wind power system. And we did this at our old age here. We started doing it when I was 65 years old. And anyhow, we don't have any electrical appliances, though.
Really?
No. And I realize that most people, you know, don't want to go that far to give up all electrical appliances.
Well, how do you like it? How's it working for you?
I love it. I absolutely love it. We have no television. We have time to read books. We have time to listen to satellite radio. I have time to write. I wrote a book about it called Not So Simple Life, Our Return to Rustic Roots. I'm going to be 75 this summer. And everything isn't finished yet. It's an incomplete house, but we do have the wind charger and three little solar panels that cost us $300 to start.
Wow. Mary, good for you. Thanks for calling. I appreciate it. Sam is calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes. Hi to everybody. Back in 1980, I had the luxury of being able to build a new home. That is, hired it to be built, and it was one of these factory-built deals, Acorn Structures. They have very high-quality factory homes, and among their various designs that they had offered at that time were three different solar designs. And so we, in fact, built an active solar house. Now, it was on 1980s technology. It was not photovoltaic. It was simply hot water. Well, simply hot water. That was our hot water and our heat. And where we were in Carlisle, it was amazing. The temperature there was always about 10 degrees colder than Boston. It was more like Quebec City temperatures than Boston temperatures. And people used to say to me, well, does it work, man? Did it work? We had oil backup. And we would use 300 gallons of oil in a Carlisle winter. Hmm. And that size house would normally have used more like about 1,200 gallons. It was wonderful. And I look so forward to doing it again. My son's a green architect, and I can't wait to get the opportunity, which I think may be coming up in the next year or so, to go 21st century with all of the, what we've learned in the last, 25 years. Beyond just the heat.
Sam, thanks so much for your call. I want to go back to Professor Brown at the University of Oregon. We talked a little bit about solar energy and the big promise that it was in the 1970s, and then everybody remembers oil prices fell again. From a historical perspective, what's different this time around in this trend with green building and solar energy and all the other things we've been talking about?
Well, I'm hoping what's different about it is that it's not going to be something that's a trend. It's going to be something that the way the future is. And I think that the global warming is a primary motivation. But I also think we're a lot better at designing and building buildings now, and so we can do them energy efficiently and do them at not much increase or no increase in first cost.
I want to get to the obstacles of building green, and Mark is calling from Boston to lead us to that topic. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. My entire neighborhood, it's a beautiful Victorian neighborhood built around 1880s, 90s, is under the protection of the National Historic Landmark Commission. And you can imagine the buildings are not very green. And I'm a trustee in my own building. And we have the dual problem of not having very much money in our reserves and also having very inefficient heating system. And we have to, every change we make has to be in accord with the Historic Commission and locally and federally. So I was wondering, some of those regulations need to be relaxed?
Jim Motovalli, what do you think?
I think maybe we can look at that. I mean, immediately the historic preservationists are going to be storming the barricades if you attempt to change those standards. But there's still a whole lot you could do even without attempting to modify a building very much. One thing you can do is blow insulation into old walls. I don't think that's going to get the preservationists to head up. Something we did at our house because we discovered that our 1927 building had very little insulation in the walls. Mm. And you don't have to take the walls down or modify them to put insulation into them. Another thing you can do, and I would say here's something that anyone in the audience, if you're intimidated by the cost or the headache of putting on a green roof, you can start small. You can look at very little things you can do. And one is putting in compact fluorescent bulbs throughout your house. Those have gotten to be so cheap and so innovative and so diverse in their style and the amount of light they put out that you'll both save money in terms of how long they last and in the amount of electricity they save. Another great thing is the automatic thermostat that dials down at night. A lot of people have started putting those in. They cost about $40, and you're going to immediately be saving energy. The tankless water heater is another thing that people have done a whole lot with. And I think your guest mentioned the low-flow shower head. And I love the idea of dual flush toilets. I'd never heard of that, but that's pretty cool.
These are good suggestions. Professor Brown, do you have anything to add to that list?
Yes, there's a very nice book on restoring historic windows. And I can't remember the reference right now, but I encourage you to look that up. And it has because windows are probably the primary source of heat loss in your building.
Professor, Amy, add to this.
Also, Energy Star, which is, I believe, a national organization, conservation services group, they will come and work with individual homeowners to redo systems inside. That's a very important part. It's not just in the historical districts. You usually can't change the outside, but it's the inside mechanicals that are important. And Energy Star has very many programs where they give you rebates. They come and help you. We'd definitely check them out.
Good suggestion. Back to the phones. Peter is calling from Bethel, Connecticut. Peter, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My brother and I are green consultants, builders, and mostly remodelers at this point. And what we've both found and feel that needs to happen is a general nationwide education of homeowners, people looking to build new homes or remodel their existing home. They need to be educated on what's out there, what's working, so that they can then, in turn, take that information to their builder, to their architect, to their designer, and demand having these things, because it is, builders are, it is a stubborn business. People aren't willing to change, and if they were armed with that information, then there'd be a push to have material suppliers supplying the materials.
Peter, thank you. Amy's shaking her head. Yes,
yeah,
please.
I also think that real estate agents really need to pay attention to this. I mean, we as an industry, we talk about the value of a home, but your home's only as valuable as the natural resources that support it. So we really need to have a fluency and an ability to kind of say, this is important, you know, pay attention to water resources, pay attention to conservation. So I think real estate agents have a role to play here as well.
Jim Motivalli, architects and designers are also an important part of this, especially behind commercial construction and commercial green building. Isn't that right?
Yeah, if you can start out in incorporating these systems into the building from the beginning, I think they're going to work a whole lot more efficiently. Because it's been pointed out to me, I think it's very true, that you can't just throw energy-efficient systems at a building. You don't get a prize for the number of energy-efficient systems you put into something. It all has to work together, or it probably won't work all that well. I think that's a very important to make. And I also want to make the point, by the way, and I think another one of the callers touched on this, is that you can dismantle older buildings instead of demolishing them. And this dismantling movement has started to gain force. And it's a great thing. For instance, at Middlebury College in Vermont, they took down their science center rather than knocking it down. And they reused all the materials. And anyone knows that older homes have some great irreplaceable wood in them. They don't. If you buy commercial wood today, you're not going to get this old growth beams and some of these really not free wood that you now see in the older buildings.
I have to tell you though, Jim, when you say that, I hear money. I hear you're going to break the bank, aren't you?
No, I've been hearing that the cost of it is not significantly higher than having your home demolished. It all depends on where you are and who you hire and all that kind of stuff. But believe it or not, you can get your house dismantled. And if you factor in the amount of money you're going to make selling the materials, it can come out fairly close to where you would otherwise be if you demolished it.
Professor Brown, you've seen, you've watched this for a long time, studied energy efficiency trends come and go over the years. Is this green building trend here to stay, do you think?
I certainly hope so.
Jim Motivalli, what do you think?
I think it's not only here to stay. I think it's going to gather force and momentum and be one of the primary things we're going to be looking at in the 21st century. Again, global warming is the major driver. Energy conservation is going to get us where we need to be, and this is a big part of energy conservation.
Amy Tai, you have the last word.
I believe it's absolutely going to it's here to stay. People really care about their homes and their planet. It's here to stay.
Amy Tai, real estate agent in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Jim Motivalli, editor of E! Magazine. Thanks for joining us. You can find a link to the magazine's cover story, Building Greener, at our website, onpointradio.org. And Professor G.Z. Brown, architecture professor at the University of Oregon in Eugene. Professor Brown, thank you.
Thanks very much, Jane.
Thanks to all of you. I appreciate your time and this Thanks. Very interesting topic.
Thanks for
thank
having
you.
Us. It's a pleasure.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.